This episode of This Week on Broadway is sponsored by SeatGeek. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, add a promo code, and enter the promo code BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. Coming up on Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway, we talk with Alan Cumming. Reviews include the Broadway production of The Humans, Prodigal Son, Dead Dog Park, Women Without Men, A Room of My Own, and the national tour of Kinky Boots at the Dr. Phillips Center for the Performing Arts. It's the climb. These chances I'm taking, these struggles I'm facing, sometimes might knock me down, but no, I'm not breaking. I may not know it, but these are the moments that I'll remember. I just gotta keep going, and I've gotta stay strong and just keep pushing on. 'Cause there's always gonna be another mountain. I'm always gonna want to make it. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway for Sunday, February 28th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Hey.
Hello. Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, James.
Matt, you have a full day here with the Academy Awards tonight, don't you?
I do. I'll be getting all the coverage ready at Broadway World as soon as we sign off.
So listeners will hear this after the Academy Awards, but you should check out, if you're interested in this, check out Matt's Some Like It Pop podcast, which last week, what was the three categories that you covered?
We did a special Oscars episode where we talked about the wish, wants, and wills that we have for the Academy Awards, what we wish had been nominated, what we want to win, and what we think will win. So we kind of ran the gamut of things on the major six categories.
It's a lot of fun to listen to, and we'll have to steal the wish, want, will in June for our Tony Award podcast.
I'm sure I stole it from somebody else, so feel free.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Broadway fans are so excited to hear from Alan Cumming, who has released a new album called Sing Sappy Songs, which is live at the Cafe Carlisle. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You know, tell us about, you know, putting together the Cafe Carlisle show. You are an artist who is highly in demand, and you can basically pick and choose your projects. You know, why did you put together this show at the Cafe Carlisle?
Well, over the last 5 or 6 years, you know, I did a cabaret show, and I just really found this new way of connecting with an audience that I really, really, really liked. And I'd kind of played out my first one was called I Bought a Blue Car Today, and then I. And in the year of when I was doing cabaret, you know, last year, during that year, I got a call from the Carlisle thing, would I like to do a new show there? And it was one of those things where I thought, I'm kind of busy, I've got a lot on my plate, but actually, I really think it's time to do a new one. And I felt like in the years I toured, I Bought a Blue Car Today around the world, I really felt I got better and understood the medium more, and I sort of found my voice, kind of literally and figuratively. So I just felt it was time to do a new one, and to also to do one that was more personal and more intimate and more kind of vulnerable. And so that's why I, in a way, the title Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs is sort of, I'm kind of hinting to the audience that, you know, it's going to be a little more of an intense experience, but also a fun one than they might have bargained on.
I'm sorry, Peter, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say,
sappy. What makes a sappy song in your estimation?
Well, for me, what I think sappy means is that it means emotional. It means like, you know, sentimental.
Uh-huh.
In a good way. It's like, and all the songs are kind of songs that I need to act or have some sort of personal connection to, and they have a lyric or a through line in them that is some sort of something that I can engage with as an actor and also as a person. I've, you know, lived a long time and had a lot of experiences. So sappy to me means kind of emotionally engaging, and perhaps a little more emotionally engaging than is sometimes comfortable.
Okay, so usually we hear The Ladies Who Lunch sung by a lady, but here we have it by you. Tell me your experience with the song when you first heard it and when you decided that it was for you.
Well, why I sing it is a few years ago I did a workshop of Company directed by John Tiffany, and it was a production that they were planning to do where, first of all, Bobby was going to be played as gay, and then some of the couples were going to have their gender changed. And so we did this workshop for a week, and I played the part that Elaine Stitch originally played in Company, and so I sang The Ladies Who Lunch. So at the end of this week, I'd, you know, learned and grown to love this amazing song. I'd always liked it, but I hadn't really listened to it. And in a way, that's what my album is about, is I'm asking people to listen to some songs that they know quite well, but me singing it makes it kind of different. So I grew to know this song and to understand it better during that workshop. And then after that, I just kind of thought, well, why don't I sing it in real life? So that's why I sing it.
Well, this is interesting, too, because you say what people are used to and do it differently. And, of course, that's what happened with you in Cabaret. For years, we always heard, oh, nobody could do that part like Joel Grey. And here you come and you do it. And now everybody, and I mean everybody who does a production of Cabaret, does it your way. And that must be pretty gratifying in a certain way. And I'd love to know how it started, what it was that was it your director who said, here's the way to play it? Or did you say to your director, here's my idea?
Wow, that's a lot of questions. let me just get to go to the first 10 and see if I can answer.
Okay.
It started in London, and I did a production of it with Sam Mendes in 1993. And I really, how it came to be the way it was a combination of arrogance on my part and also Sam's kind of, you know, being amazing, because I really wasn't very keen to do it. I was just playing Hamlet at the time, and I kind of thought, oh, I don't know if I want to do a musical. And then, you know, I was a bit like that. And then I turned it down, and then he pursued me and said, you know, I really think it could be great, and we were going to do it. The thing that got me was he said, we're going to turn the Donmar, which is the Donmar Warehouse in London where we did it, into an actual club, and it's going to be as though the audience were at a Weimar club. And I really liked that. That really appealed to me. And then as we talked more and in the rehearsals, you know, I insisted, and he wanted to make it as gritty and as kind of as realistic to what one of those clubs and what the people who worked in those clubs would be like. And, you know, and it's not a very high class club, the Kit Kat Club. It's not one of the more biting satirical ones of the Weimar Republic. It's more, you know, there's probably naughty business going on up the back. And so I felt that I tried very hard to create a character that would exude and represent a sexuality and a moment in time. And to try and make that was what we tried to do with the whole production. So that's how my interpretation of the role, that was the sort of genesis of it. And then, but, you know, I think when people ask me these things about Joel and everything quite a lot, I what I say is I actually think that it's such a great role. I mean, I think Cabaret is one of the greatest musicals ever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a great role because it's not very defined. And, you know, I just played Hamlet. So when you play big characters like that, you're used to being compared to other people who have done definitive, you know, versions of it, of their generation. And I think the thing is that because it's a relatively new production, a new play, and the only two big sort of productions of it that people remember are Joel's and me, in terms of those characters, I think actually it's such a great role, and it's got such loose parameters, and you can kind of do what you like with it. I'm sure that in 10 years' time, there'll be another big production event, and someone else will redefine it, and we'll be talking about him. And I actually the fact that everyone copies me, I see pictures all the time of, you know, people doing productions, and they have the harness thing, and they have my, I, 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 it is, it is flattering in a way, but I actually think, oh, I wish you'd just do it your way. Find somewhere you need to do it. Don't just copy me, because the play is much better than that, you know? So it's a double-edged sword. It is nice, but I kind of grow a little tired of it, and I wish people would be inspired by me doing it my way and do it their way.
What about the aspect of it that you had 10 years off to play that same role on
and
Broadway?
You didn't look a second older.
In fact, you looked younger.
Bless you. That's very nice. You're sleeping at your specs on. Well, it was actually longer than 10 years. It was 1998 I did it. And then I went back in 2014, so that's 16 years.
Yeah.
16 years, God. well, you know, it was many things. Mostly, though, I'm really, really glad I did it. It was a challenging thing, you know. I turned 50 when I was doing it, and I was dancing up. I was like, you know, the lead dancer in a Broadway show, which is hilarious. Just that sentence is hilarious. But so, you know, it was a little more, I felt it a little more. But, it was great. It was so great to be that fit. I mean, I remember when I finished Cabaret the first time around in New York, I just remember thinking, God, I'm never going to have this body again. I'm never going to be this in shape and this sort of, you know. And then, you know, there I was again. But actually, the thing why I'm really glad I did it was the first time around, you know, I'd just come to New York to do Cabaret. I was on my own living here. I just was finding my feet. The whole experience was so huge and overwhelming, and I didn't understand. I had no kind of experience to compare it to in about doing a Broadway show. I had nowhere to kind of place it, and it was just a massive amount of attention and positive. It was a great experience, but it was, as I say, overwhelming. And so it was so lovely to come back to it older and wiser, and to enjoy it more, enjoy how potent the show is and the message of this production was, and to enjoy the experience of, you know, being in this great huge hit on Broadway again and not being sort of scared by it.
Matt, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was just going to ask about the, coming back to the Alan Cumming sing sappy songs, the set list of both the show and then this album are so diverse in the songs that you pick. I wonder what goes into the process of when you're putting this together, saying, I want to do this song and I want to take this approach to it. What was the thought process in trying to compile something that was completely unique and so diverse and pulled from so many different inspirational sources?
Well, it was really, you know, as I said earlier, a thing about an emotional connection. I felt that all the songs were songs that I either really wanted to sing or grew to love during that year when I was doing Cabaret. Because, you know, I would have parties in my dressing room, and it was called Club Cumming, and I would sort of DJ, and I would play these songs, and I would get really, you know, people would suggest things. I would, so in a way, they were all, although they're a very diverse collection, they're all songs that I feel a personal connection to, and songs I really wanted to sing, and also songs that I felt like I could bring something to, because I think there's loads of songs in the world that it would be no point in me singing just because I'm not that kind of singer. I'm not like a kind of, you don't listen to my voice and think, you know, wow, what a beautiful mellifluous tone. I mean, I have a nice voice, but actually I think I'm better at interpreting. I'm an interpreter. And so they're all songs that I feel I can bring something to. So and also they reflect my personality. You know, the show's about me, and I tell stories about my own experience, my own life. And so the songs all reflect the eclecticism and the range of my personality.
With that album, with the show and then the album, following up fairly closely on the heels with your memoir, it seems like you're, and I don't want to speak for you, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but it just seems like the public persona of what you're letting people see behind the curtain a little bit has become a little more prevalent in the last few years. Is that something that you were cognizant of, or is it just a natural progression of your social, you know, persona?
I mean, I think both, actually. I've realized over the years that the things I've been most proud of and most that I think are most successful in my work, kind of, and in my life too, but that's another story, but are things that I revealed a bit more about myself. And like the film I made with Jennifer Jason Leigh called The Anniversary Party, we wrote characters that were very similar to ourselves, and we talked about things that we were going through in our real lives. And there's other productions, like Bent in the West End about 10 years ago, I really felt a very personal connection to that story. And I felt it was, you know, I felt I was doing better work because I was being very Raw. And then, of course, you know, more recently, yes, with my book. But in general, in all my work, I think as I've got older, I've got a better understanding of being an artist. For me, it's about being authentic and truthful and connecting with an audience. And so doing it in a very open way, like with my book and like with the show, to me is like the zenith of what it is I want to do. So it's a really great time, because I feel there's been a lot of these kind of experiences are happening in my work. And even when there's things that are not about me, I feel like I'm getting better at connecting with an audience, because I guess the more well-known you get, people know stuff about you, so they kind of feel they have a better connection to you when they see you playing another character as well. So it's been a really great kind of lesson that the more vulnerable and authentic you are, the better experience is going to be for both you and the audience.
So in deeper into the song list, I thought that really I was the only person in the world that ever played a Goodnight Saigon over and over and over. So tell me what Goodnight Saigon, the Billy Joel song, means to you.
Well, it's a song that I actually, there's a woman I love in Scotland, well, she was in Scotland at the time, called Teddy Neeson. She was an amazing Scottish actress and singer. And she, I remember I saw a show she did like in the 80s, and she sang, it was on a TV show that I did with her. I was doing a stand-up comedy act with another boy, and we were guests on her TV show in Scotland, and she sang Goodnight Saigon. And I remember just being so blown away by the power of this song that, you know, said so much about war and about the Vietnam War in particular, and just was so emotional and beautiful. It always was in my head, and I always loved it. And then, you know, with this show, I talked about my grandfather who died in Malaysia, he played Russian roulette and he died, and he was very, very damaged in the Second World War, and kind of, you know, he sort of spiraled afterwards, and that's how he ended his life. So I felt like I wanted to do something that was sing a song in some way that had a message about the horrors of war and the dangers of how damaging it is to people. So that's I remembered that song and I did it for him. That's like when I talk about it in my show, I talk a little about him and then I sing that song.
So your memoir that we talked about, Not My Father's Son, came out last year, and you also had a novel, Tommy's Tale, in 2002. So tell us about Tommy's can we expect more writing from you?
I've kind of always written various things. I've only had published two books thus far, which is Tommy's Tale was a novel that is a kind of a. They republished it actually last year, and before my memoir came out, and they had a very good byline. It was like a tale of love, sex, and happy endings. And it's quite a racy novel, a racy, saucy novel, but it's really about the overwhelming kind of theme of it was about being fatherhood, about becoming a father. And it's about a character who wants to have a child, but is not in a situation to have one. And actually, it's interesting, in the time that when I wrote it and when it came out compared to now, I mean, I guess it would be much easier for Tommy to, as a single bisexual man, he could have a child. It would be much more socially acceptable and actually easier in terms of the way things would change. But it was about the novel was about my desire at that time to become a father. Mm-hmm. And then my memoir now, it was about the summer that I spent in 2010 when I did that BBC show, Who Do You Think You Are? And I find all this stuff out about my granddad, the one I just mentioned. And then right before I started filming that, my father, who I'd not seen for nearly 20 years, came out of the woodwork to tell me that I wasn't his biological son. So I had this really crazy summer of learning, finding all this stuff out about my granddad, a man I never knew, and finding out about my father, a man I did know very well, that, you know, really the whole story was not how I thought it was. So that's what my memoir is about. And it's, I'm very, very proud of it. I think it's been a great thing. It's been very well received as a work of literature, and it's done really well. But also it's really, I've got so much response from people saying how much it's helped them to hear me talk about, you know, an abusive situation in my childhood and enabled them to discuss things and confront their families with similar things. So that's been a really lovely thing.
Speaking of racy, the album cover, there you are, naked with a strategically placed bottle of champagne, mm-hmm. and my compliments that the bottle is such a large one. Whose idea was it to do that album cover?
Well, it's actually, it wasn't an album cover to start with. It was a photo that I made with this an amazing photographer called Jordan Matter, and he does these shots of dancers. He sort of specializes in taking dancers, you know, mid-flight. And he was doing this project called Dancers After Dark. It's actually up on a gallery right now on 65th Street. But anyway, he asked me if I would do this project. He wanted to take pictures of dancers naked after, you know, at nightfall. And I was terribly flattered to be thought of as a dancer, and so I said yes. And I took the picture whilst I was doing the show at the Carlisle last summer. But I was supposed to do it back down in East Village where I live. But too many guests were in that night, too many friends, and I had guests in my suite at the Carlisle, and so I couldn't get away to go down to the East Village. So I said, couldn't you just come up here and we'll do it? And he said, oh yeah, we could do it near Central Park. I was like, all right. But they still stayed on. So basically, he came to my room and we had a couple of drinks. I said, why don't we just do it outside? So we kind of called up these two dancers at like 2 a.m, and these people I'd never met came over to the Carlisle and took their clothes off with me. I mean, we practiced in the room first, the pose we were going to do. And then because Jordan had seen there was that big bottle of champagne was there because I'd hosted the Tonys and my managers had sent it for me. So that was why he got the idea of them presenting to me. So it was all this kind of crazy accident. And we just ran downstairs, practiced a little with our clothes on, and then just took our clothes off. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was on the Upper East Side, thankfully, so nobody's out after 10 o'clock, so it was fine. Nobody came along. But, you know, you worry about a tourist not knowing that. I was actually literally naked on the streets in the Upper East Side at 2 o'clock in the morning with two strangers. So then we took that picture, and then when we were going to do the live. I mean, the reason we did the live album at the Carlisle is because I thought it would be so good to have that picture on the cover.
Well, I think we just sold a lot more albums for you by then.
Yes.
Absolutely. Well, you're going to be selling a lot of albums because you're going to be touring around the United States for the next couple of months. You're coming up mm-hmm. in Naples, in Detroit, yes. in Minnesota, at the McCarter. Yeah. So, Peter, we can go see him at the McCarter Friday, March 13th, Friday the 13th.
Ah. No, it's not a Friday, is it?
It says Friday, May 13th.
May 13th.
Did I say March? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
McCarter, okay. Friday, May 13th, and Port Washington on Saturday, May 14th, and then Dallas and places other in Texas. Texas, scary. Uh-huh. All right. So
I can handle Texas.
All right.
If anybody can handle Texas, it's you. Absolutely. So, Alan, thank you so much for joining us on Broadway Radio.
You're welcome.
We really, really we're big, huge fans of you, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about The Good Wife, but maybe we'll do that sometime in the future.
All right, well, be quick, because there's only 9 more episodes, and it's over forever.
It lives on forever in Netflix for us.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, right, too, yes. You've got a while then, probably.
All right, well, we will speak with you soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This week's episode is sponsored by SeatGeek. SeatGeek has taken all the work and hassle out of shopping for tickets. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They've made it easier than ever to buy and sell tickets for theater, sports, and music. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on all the sites in one place so you can save time and you never miss a deal. Best of all, SeatGeek is honest and upfront about the price. Unlike other ticket sites, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Broadway Radio listeners can get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. To get your $20 rebate on tickets, download the free SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Enter our code, which is BR20. SeatGeek will send you $20 after you made your first ticket purchase. If you are a fan of Broadway Radio, I hope that you will support SeatGeek. Download the app and give it a try. Okay, in our discussion of reviews today, the three of us, meaning me and Michael and Peter, got a chance to see The Humans for a second time this season because previously it was off-Broadway, and it has moved to the Helen Hayes Theater, where it is playing on Broadway now, and we were re-invited. So, Peter, how was the second time for you?
Well, what's most fascinating to me is that the first time around, I went to a preview, where therefore the audience had no idea what it was getting. And under those circumstances, it was interesting to see them sit there and watch the play and go home afterwards, and that was that. Now, I was at the performance right after the reviews came out, the second official performance, and my, the place is rocking with laughter. Now, I'm telling you, laughs laugh for seconds on end, because, of course, the critics have given permission and saying that this is this smash hit. So, under those circumstances, what can people do but go and agree with the critics? So, it was a very different experience under those circumstances. Did I like the play more? Yeah, in fact, I did a little. It still won't be one of my favorites, but I was impressed that the energy that the audience had certainly translated into the energy that the actors had as well. And there's something wonderful about watching actors who know they're in a hit. And all that, gee, how are we doing here? The audience isn't responding, just wasn't there at the Helen Hayes. So as a result, audience feeds actors who feed audience right back, and it was a much more enervating experience. And good luck to everybody associated with the humans.
Michael, what did you think?
Peter, that's so funny that that's the first thing you mentioned, because that's the first thing I noticed.
Was it really?
Yeah. And it's amazing. We after the show, I stopped at Sardi's with my theater companion, and the whole cast came in.
Ah.
And I know Reed Birney a little bit. I've met him a few times before, and we went over and spoke with him, and he was just incredibly gracious. And, you know, we told him how much we loved him. And I mentioned that. I said I had seen the show off Broadway, and it seemed to me that there were four times the laughter now on Broadway. And he said, oh, absolutely. But it is interesting, because it's not – I mean, I don't think the reviews are portraying it as primarily a comedy, which it is not overall, even though there's a tremendous amount of humor in it, and really great humor. Some of the lines are just priceless. I was going to quote some of them, but I don't want to spoil anything. So that is a phenomenon I've noticed before. I think I mentioned it with The Light in the Piazza, of all things. These are shows that are not primarily even comedic, but yes, rave reviews seem to induce greater audience response, and that's just an interesting phenomenon. I also would say I like the play a little more the second time, because the problems I had with it are still evident, and I actually paid very, very close attention to make sure, because my main problem with the play, as I mentioned the first time, is that the theme of the play, as I see it, is that the most frightening things in life, the most scary and frightening and saddening things in life, are just the things that happen normally in life, not monsters, not supernatural occurrences, not anything like that. And yet, it seemed to me when I saw the play the first time that there were a few things that happen in the play that do not seem realistic and could only be explained as supernatural. So I paid attention very, very closely this time, and I still do feel that. There are two things at the end especially that I cannot see any rational explanation for. Although apparently the director and the writer do have some kind of explanation, because I'm told that in talkbacks during the off-Broadway production, this specific issue was addressed, and they said that during rehearsals or previews for the off-Broadway version, they had made a point of removing anything that could not be explained naturally. So I don't know. There are a couple of lines that I think are there to attempt to explain the things that happened. The young man of the couple that lives in the apartment says something to the effect of, it's an old apartment and it shifts. So I think that's supposed to try to explain it, but it didn't work for me. And I just wish that maybe someday I'll have a conversation with Stephen Karam or Joe Mantello, and they'll be able to tell me what their explanations are. Yeah. For them. But that said, the writing, you know, the writing is really extraordinary. The acting is beyond any form of reproach. It's Reed Birney, Cassie Beck, Sarah Steele, the great Jane Howdyshell, Lauren Klein, and Ariane Moyed under Joe Hamilton. Joe Mantello's direction, as I said. And the set is quite amazing. It's just so creepy without being obviously creepy in any obvious way. That's David Zinn, by the way. And the way the humor dovetails with the existential dread in the play, it's very, very well done. Stephen Karam is getting a tremendous amount of attention and has for this, and some people think it might win the Pulitzer and it might win the Tony. And I, despite my problems with those few moments in the play, I think all of that is very well deserved.
So I have nothing to add because both of you have said exactly everything that I felt that off-Broadway, I got a single ticket to it, and there was very low energy, and I felt that, you know, what's this all about? And then seeing it on Broadway a couple of nights ago, it was like, you know, the energy equivalent of people walking in to see Hamilton. Mm-hmm. You know,
it really was, yeah.
The rave reviews were just amazing, and people saying that this is, you know, the Tony Award race is over, and this is going to win a Pulitzer, and I think that it'll probably win a Nobel too, and a Universe Award, and maybe even a Broadway World Award. But
I don't know. That's high standards there, James.
It's very high standards there. So I'm gonna
make one observation, though. I wonder what it's like sitting in the first row of the Helen Hayes Theater, because this is a multi-level set, set, you know, and a lot of it happens on the upper level, and I'm not sure how well you can see from there. So I don't know if they have a lottery where they have the first two rows at lower prices. They may very well. But I do want to caution listeners that if they do go to the humans, they may have a problem if they're in the first row.
Might be the perfect place.
Yes, this is another case, as Peter mentioned recently, where sometimes the cheaper seats are the better ones.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. In this case, I would say that front mezzanine is probably a fantastic seat for this show. And it's great at the Helen Hayes, too. It's the perfect theater for it.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it better the second time. My wife came with me the second time to see it, and I kind of said, well, I'm really thrilled about this, but I'm going back because I really have to go back to it. And we left the theater, and she goes, that was pretty good. You didn't like it? And I was like, no, this time I liked it. So, we'll take it from there. And, you know, listeners, if you have some feedback, you know, email us and let us know what you thought about the humans at Helen Hayes. Next up, we have Prodigal Son at Manhattan Theater Club. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
This is a play by John Patrick Shanley about a very, very, very apparently intensely autobiographical play about his time in a boarding school. And he apparently, it's the name given to his character is not John. It's actually Jim Quinn, played by Timothy Chalamet. And then we have Robert Sean Leonard as Alan Hoffman, who is a teacher who takes a real strong interest in Jim. And then Chris McGarry is the teacher who brings Jim into the school, and another character is his wife, Louise Schmidt, played by Annika Boris, and then the only other character who appears briefly is another student, Austin, played by David Potters, and it's basically about how young Jim is obviously brilliant, but very troubled and a troublemaker, and are they going to be able to basically tame him to the point where he can, you know, be a decent member of society without tamping down his brilliance? And I guess my main problem with the play is that he t- to me came across as so incredibly difficult that I just really didn't like him. And I would say that's a problem, even though I, you know, could appreciate his intelligence and his, you know, his brilliance, which was obvious in many of the things that he said. That was a huge problem I had. And then there is some homosexual panic thing that happens at the end of the play that really turned me off to it tremendously. I wouldn't have thought of this as a pattern until now, but when you look at this play and then you also look at Doubt, I'm thinking that maybe Shanley has an issue with that. That's something I'd like to – I wonder if he's addressed that specifically in interviews. I'll have to see if I can look that up. I did like a lot of the writing, but I also thought it seemed very schematic. I thought it went on too long. I thought there were too many examples of young Jim being very, very difficult and recalcitrant and actually annoying. And even though the play was not long at all, it was about 90 minutes without an intermission. That's my feeling. The acting was excellent across the board. Timothy Chalamet is extraordinary. Apparently he is known for Homeland, and also he was in Interstellar. So a lot of people will know him from that. He was really great. I thought he was superb, and it's to the point where I can't really picture anyone else playing the role. But I would suggest, although I think it's too late, I'm surprised someone else hasn't told him this, that he might change the spelling of his first name, because he's not only does he spell it T-I-M-O-T-H-E-E, but the first E has an accent aigu on it. And, Karen Ziemba knew enough to take the accent aigu out of her name years ago. I'm really surprised that his agents and managers have allowed this. And I think it's a mistake and people are always going to get it wrong, but we'll see.
All right. Peter, what did you think?
Well, the one thing I want to talk about is what specifically happened last Sunday afternoon at the matinee, and that was the fact that, all right, so here's this kid who's really just so, so annoying in so many ways, irrational, troublesome, argumentative, all that kind of business. And yes, the actor is really a wonder in the role. The body language is so eloquent, the lanky walk, the shoulders that are slumped, the head's cocked to one side, you know, all arms and legs on a real thin body. It's what you've seen on thousands of teenagers, which makes it exactly right. All right, so here he is, arguing with a teacher and trying to make his points known and what's wrong and what's wrong with the school and all this kind of business. And at that moment, in the very first row, dead center, right in front of him, two people start walking out. And to be fair, they look quite elderly, and we can give them the benefit of the doubt in saying that perhaps there was a medical emergency. Frankly, I'd rather that they didn't like the play, and that's the reason, but it could be that. But whatever happened, they were leaving, and he waved bye-bye to them. So now that's breaking the fourth wall, but in a strange way, it is in character, isn't it, that he doesn't care what they think either. I mean, so I'm with Michael on the gay thing, because Robert Sean Leonard is this altruistic teacher for so much of the show, and right. Then find out that he has a hidden agenda. Now, one of the things that bothers me, too, in Legally Blonde is that the professor, too, seems to be very interested in Elle Wood, and he's so impressed at how she's come along such a long way. And then he makes a pass at her, too. And I hate that when I see a teacher who's put in that position, be it heterosexual or homosexual, because this is not my experience with teachers, either as a student or somebody who has a background in teaching. Teachers are pretty altruistic, and I don't like them shown this way, and who knows, for all I know, this goes on all the time, but I can't say from my experiences that I've ever seen it happen at all. So under these circumstances, I hated seeing this part of the play. However, as Michael says, this is not a biographical play, so you know, maybe this is exactly what happened to John Patrick Shanley way back when, and he's just telling the truth. But boy, wouldn't it be nice to see a teacher who was really out for his students just because he wanted them to succeed and nothing else.
Get over to Manhattan Theater Club if this is something that interests you. Sounds like it's a very complex play.
There was, I would say, one positive thing to me after all of that, which was the absolute low point of the play, the part that Peter was just discussing, where all of that comes out. There is, I thought it was very well done. There's the final scene that sort of takes place in the past and the present at the same time. And I thought the way that Shanley wove those together, the way that Jim is talking to his memories of the people in a way and saying what, you know, filling us in what happened to them and saying, telling them how he felt about, you know, their place in his life. I thought that was very well done just from a technical standpoint. So I just wish that other stuff hadn't been in there.
All right. So let's move forward. Peter got over to 59 East 59 to see Dead Dog Park. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
What I want to say is, as I was leaving the theater, very impressed with the play, very impressed with the production. I was shocked to see that one of the producers was a company called Boz and the Bard. Now, in my Star Ledger days, I used to go occasionally to Hackensack and see productions by this tiny little company. And I'm so proud of them for making the leap to New York and making the leap with a play that is truly, truly wonderful. I will admit it's tough going because it deals with a very tough subject. We're talking about a policeman who is being accused of being so upset with one of the young black people who's running away from him that he winds up throwing him out a window. He claims he didn't. Nobody saw anything. His partner gives us the impression that he may have seen something, but he claims he saw nothing, that he was in a different part of the building. His wife doesn't believe him. And that's very potent as well, because we really expect that his wife is going to stand by him. That doesn't happen in any way, shape, or form. And that's one of the big tragedies of the play, that when things get tough. To be fair, too, this was not the first time at all. When they had trouble, and that comes up too. And so you don't get a courtroom trial in the sense of hear ye, all rise. There's nothing like that. There's no judge. But you get little snippets from the trial here, there, and everywhere from the boy's mother, from the lawyer, of the prosecuting attorney, of course, and the partner. Here, there, and everywhere, you hear little snatches of what would happen in the trial. It's a very simple set. I mean, it's a table and a few chairs, and that's it. So it's not a realistic trial, but it does certainly pack a wallop of tremendous proportions, because this is certainly an issue we are faced with from time to time here in New York City. The police, is there such a thing as police brutality that crosses the line, especially when it comes to young black men? This is a question that's been asked for a long time, needless to say, and there have been different opinions on this, and you get a lot of different opinions in Dead Dog Park, which very, 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 very nicely directed by Eric Tucker, and the script by Barry Malawer, Malawer, who really has done a fine job. I don't know if he's had, like John Patrick Shanley, an autobiographical experience here, but it's the type of play that makes you feel bad for everybody. Now, that may not be the type of thing you want to do when you're out for a night on the town, I'll grant you, but still, if we're looking for powerful theater, if we're looking for real meaty issues, the social commentary, Dead Dog Park at 59 East 59th in the very small theater upstairs, not in the main stage, is certainly quite wonderful. And my hat is off to the people from The Boz and the Bard, which, by the way, is named for both Dickens and Shakespeare, their two favorite authors. So tremendous work. And I hope this is just the beginning of Boz and the Bard crossing the river and giving us tremendous nights in the theater.
All right, next up, Michael and Peter got to see Women Without Men at the Mint. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Yes, I reviewed this show for Talkin' Broadway, so I won't go on and on. I'll just give a brief précis and have Peter take over. Maybe we can link to my review. But this is one of the best, one of the absolute best productions that the Mint has ever done that I've seen. And that is saying something, because they're one of the absolute best off-Broadway companies we have. This is a play by Hazel Ellis, an Irish playwright, written mid-30s, and it's set in a private school in Ireland. And all of the action takes place in the sitting the teacher's lounge. They call it a sitting room. And there's a newbie to the faculty. Her name is Jean Wade, played by Emily Walton. And, you know, it's kind of what you would expect. She's a little nervous about the new job, but she, you know, she's also very enthusiastic and just idealistic and hoping to do a really good job. But as soon as she gets there, she is confronted by all the office politics type stuff and petty jealousies and quirks of the other faculty members, and you know, there are various types of interpersonal relationships going on among the women, but nothing terribly difficult until it seems that for some reason there develops this great antipathy between Jean and this one other faculty member named Miss Connor, played by Kelly Overby. And Miss Connor, even though she seems to be the most frosty, unemotional, cold person among the faculty, she's writing a book about a history of beautiful acts throughout the ages, or some title title like that, which seems very incongruous. And I think that's the playwright's point. But to make a long story short, she's writing this book and she's been working on it for 20 years. And she has this manuscript carrying around in a little box. And all of a sudden, one day, it's discovered that the manuscript has been ripped to shreds. And the question is, well, Jean is sort of the prime suspect because everyone is aware of this conflict between the two of them. And so the question is, will she take the fall for it? Will it turn out that she actually did it or not? And that's the main dramatic action of the play. But it's really about the characters and the milieu, this wonderful look back at a time so distant from our own, and a country distant from our own. And the production is letter perfect, from the dialect work, which is superb, to the props, to the sets, the costumes, everything in it. Across the board, the acting is just brilliant. I would single out as Jean, Emily Walton, and also Mary Bacon as one of the other teachers. She's been in several productions and other things that I've seen, but most of all, Kelly Overby, who really, I've always liked her, but she's just brilliant as Miss Connor. It's a wonderful, wonderful performance, and I would, if for that alone, I'm glad I saw the play. But there was so much else to it. And the other good news, quickly, is that for quite some years, the Mint had been performing in a space, an upstairs space in a building on 43rd Street that had its pluses, but it also had its minuses. The stage was wide but very low. The rows were unbroken. The rake was not really the pitch, the rake, the pitch of the audience seats was really not conducive to not having heads blocking your view to a certain extent. And also there was very little legroom and it was very claustrophobic. But now I'm not sure of the reasons why they left that place, but they have left. And this show is their first in a different space, and it's at Manhattan City Center Stage 2. Which is the right next to Prodigal Son, actually, and it's a sort of a more of like a large black boxy kind of space, very malleable in terms of not so much malleable, I guess, in terms of seating. Almost everything I've seen there has been three-quarter thrust, although this one I think it was audience on two sides. But my point is it just has a much more open feeling. There's a nice rake to the seats. There are aisles. And there's a lot of space above the actors, which makes everything feel less claustrophobic. So even in that respect, this is one of the best things that they've ever done. And they tend to have fairly long runs, so please try to get to it.
All right, Peter, what did you think?
Michael, what were the assets of the previous Midspace? I can't think of
anything. Oh, well, I guess location.
All right, yes.
And also,
all right.
As I said in my review, and also for what it's worth, permanence. I mean, it was their home, and they were there all the time, and so people became familiar with it. But yes, I don't. Yeah, I mean, you're right.
One thing that I'm crazy about this play, by the way, and the production as well. And once again, Jonathan Banks, how does he do it? How does he find them? You know, one of the things that's most impressive to me was hearing that Jonathan told me that he often goes on IBDB, where they have little arrows at the top saying previous production, next production during any season. And he just, you know, picks like 1921, 22 and starts looking. And if something catches his eye, that's fine. But this play was never produced on Broadway. So I don't know where he found it or how he found it, but I'm very glad he found it. Michael said it very, very well. He described the plot perfectly. I did find it interesting that one of the things that caused a problem here was that Miss Connor, yes, the perfectly pent-up Kelly Overby, detests Miss Wade, Emily Walton, and goes out of her way to stop Wade's drama club production from proceeding. Even in 1937 Ireland, people in schools wanted to stop the arts from flourishing. It's not something new. So there we are. And it does seem like the teacher who's the nicest is the one that must be destroyed. And that's part of what goes on here, too. So I hate the title. Not as a title, but I don't think it has anything to do with these women not having men. This has to do with professionalism or the lack thereof. Yes, one of them is involved with a man, and yes, one of them may leave teaching because she can get married, and which, after all, was something that would be a topic in 1937. So not as much today, of course, But I don't think that these women not having men in their lives is what makes them what they are. They're just in a school setting, and one of the things that can happen to some people – oh, God, am I going to get in trouble with this remark? One of the things that can happen with some people who teach is that they become the biggest kid in the classroom. And as a result, they don't mature in a way that you do in other businesses, because suddenly what's this expression of water at the soul level? I mean, you can sink down to the level of the kids very easily. And that may be very much what's happening here, too, that these people who have been used to dealing with children become childish. Now, again, this is not an indictment of teachers whom I love dearly, but I have seen this happen in some people Not a lot, but it did come to mind that some people here were acting very childishly, and where did that come from? So I don't believe that this is where the Mint is going to be. I do believe their next production is going to be on Theater Row. But I, as an interim spot, it really is as terrific as Michael said. But more impressive was the script by this playwright that I imagine none of us had ever heard of before. And Jen Thompson directed it so superbly.
Yes.
So that was really quite wonderful, too. I also have to say that this is the first time I've seen Emily Walton since she was in A Stroller when she was about 1 or 2 years old. You know, so all grown up and doing a wonderful job. Her father is Bob Walton, the brother of Jim Walton. And he was doing a musical review in Traverse City, Michigan, and that's where I met him, his wife, and their little girl. Traverse City, Michigan. Is there any place I don't go to see theater? Any?
No, there is not.
I guess that's the answer.
You know, Peter, your point about – I did want to add your point about the title was very well taken. I actually, in my review for Talking Broadway, I said that it sounds like it could be the title of a porno flick. Yeah. Or it could be a title of one of those trashy lesbian novels from the 50s, or maybe one of those one of the women in prison things like Orange is the New Black or Cage. But the Cage, the point is, yeah, as compared to, for example, the Claire Booth Luce play, the women in that play, even though it's only female characters as well, they spend 2/3 of their time talking about
men. Sure,
and in this case, very little time. Some discussion of Jean's fiance, as mentioned, and maybe one or two other people. But that, yeah. So I do wish the title had been changed, but maybe it's intriguing. So maybe it helps people get into the.
It is, and the irony is that the women by Claire Booth Luce is around the same period. 1937. It's got to be within striking distance of that year. So, so two women in two different countries had women on their minds. So,
and also, I'm just realizing the coincidence of these two plays currently playing at City Center right next to each other that are both about set in schools.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Peter, my question for you, unrelated to this show, is how many continents have you seen shows on?
Every place but Africa. Well, and of course Antarctica. Oh, please. But that's one of these days we'll see what happens.
We have to start a big campaign to get you to Africa.
That's right, a Kickstarter.
GoFundMe or Kickstarter to get Peter to Africa and Antarctica. I think that there's some research stations in Antarctica that they have to put on some sort of skit to keep themselves busy through the winter.
Cape Town supposedly has a wonderful theater scene, so maybe that's where I'll be heading after the season's over.
All right, so before we get to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream us directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at Broadway Radio, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. All right, Michael, do you have a trivia question for this week?
Yes, I do, and again, this is one that may have multiple answers, but there are at least two that I know of. In at least two cases of musicals, there was a song from each of these two musicals that was cut at some time before the show opened, but then the music alone of the two songs were used at the very beginning of each show. So name the shows and name the piece of music if you can.
All right, great. If you think you know the answer to this, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Another reason not to move. another podcast stinger. Here's to the girls on the go, everybody tries. Look into their eyes and you'll see what they know. Everybody dies. A toast to that invincible bunch, the dinosaurs surviving the crunch. Let's hear it for the ladies who lunch. Everybody dies.
Good night.